What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Welcome to Hollywood and Levine.
Never standing down for my podcast watch, this is Ken Levine. Welcome to Hollywood and Levine, episode 56. And this is a good one. You are going to forget that you are on the Stairmaster. You are going to be so engrossed in my interview today with Preston Beckman. I'll tell you who he is. Every May, the networks come out with their fall schedules, right? And then in January, we have the mid-season schedules. Well, who sets these schedules? Okay, who are the guys who decide what show goes where? Preston Beckman is one of the best. Now, you may know him on Twitter as the Masked Scheduler, but for 20 years, he was at NBC. He was there during the must-see TV era. And for 15 years, he was at Fox. Recently, I had a chance to sit down with him, and it was such a good interview that I'm cutting it up into two parts. So this is part one. Next week is part two. Today, we get into Cheers and Seinfeld, American Idol, 24, why Fox cannot launch a comedy, what people really do watch on Netflix, and that might surprise you. We'll get into demographics, who the real target audience is. We'll talk about the X-Files a little bit and binge watching. So a lot of good stuff. Get on the Stairmaster. Preston Beckman, here we go.
Hollywood and Levine.
Okay, well, first I want to start off by talking a little history. You were at NBC in 1982 when Cheers began, and as a producer of Cheers, I was always worried that we were going to get canceled because our ratings were so terrible. How close to the precipice were we those early days?
I don't think you were ever close to the precipice. Again, I was in research
right
during the early days, but Cheers was for people at NBC something different from Different Strokes and Facts of Life.
Right.
It was an attempt to do a more adult comedy, and it was very smart. And I honestly, the sense I talked to Brandon Tarkoff and Warren Littlefield a lot, was that the show was never in jeopardy.
Uh-huh.
In fact, my wife's water broke in the middle of an episode of Cheers.
And you continued to watch, of course.
No, I couldn't. I couldn't, but right in the middle, she stood up and her water broke. And fortunately, I had seen the episode earlier in the day at work.
Thank God, because otherwise, you know, you'd have to say to her, look, it's just 10 more minutes.
I told her it was a funny episode. You didn't have much of a choice.
Well, you went to Los Angeles in 1991.
Yes.
So you're also involved in Seinfeld.
Yes.
And Seinfeld is such an interesting case because my understanding was that NBC gave Jerry Seinfeld a sitcom pretty much to keep him in the bullpen because they wanted him available should Carson retire. And so they figure, well, they'll just, you know, have him do this. And didn't they pretty much hate the pilot when they first saw it?
No. Well, first of all, whenever I talk about Seinfeld, the first thing I have to do is give props to Rick Ludwin, who was the head of late night and who was the advocate for Jerry and for the show.
Right.
And actually, the show did not come about in the normal development process, but basically Rick took money from his specials budget to make the pilot.
Ah, okay.
And Rick was and Jerry and Larry David never wanted the show to be handled or managed in the conventional format of having the current executive run the show.
Sure.
So Rick Ludwin was the current executive throughout the history of Seinfeld.
Okay.
The first year I came out for pilots while I was still in research was 1989, and that was the year that we screened the Seinfeld Chronicles. And honestly, I think that the reaction was pretty positive for most of the people in the screening room. The testing wasn't all that good.
Yeah, get into that later.
The testing wasn't all that good. But honestly, one of the biggest detractors was Brandon Tartikoff, who felt he did say in the room the show was too Jewish and too New York for the country. Uh-huh. But I think among the program executives and others in the room, it was, again, just sort of like Cheers. It was, okay, we're not doing those, you know, Different Strokes, Facts of Life comedies. We're trying to become more adult and smarter in what we were doing.
Right. And Warren Littlefield, who replaced Brandon,
yes,
was a fan.
Yes.
So I guess that was kind of the turning point for the show actually getting on the schedule.
Well, the show, if you remember, the show was not picked up for the fall 89 schedule.
Right.
Brandon, I believe, agreed to make about 4 episodes. We actually, as we used to do back in those days, we would air pilots as a way to amortize the cost of a pilot.
We used to call it failure theater.
Yes, exactly.
The writers would call it failure theater.
We did also. And we aired the Seinfeld pilot on a Thursday night after Cheers. And it held, it was just Cheers repeat, but it held a surprisingly large amount of the audience, and I think that convinced Brandon to order a few episodes. So we ordered a few. We screened it again. We ordered a few. We ordered, I think, 13, and then the Gulf War broke out, and we had to change part of the schedule and everything. So the show really didn't get on the air until 91 as a regular fall show.
Right.
So it took a while for the show to take hold.
And it wasn't an instant hit.
No.
However, back in those days, because I remember Cheers, the first year we were getting a 19 share, and Brandon was, quoted once as saying, do you really want to live in a world where Cheers gets a 19 share? But, you know, Seinfeld was getting that kind of number too, but that was still like about 15, 16 million people, right?
Yeah, also, you know, Seinfeld was on against Home Improvement.
Which
originally
was like a top 10 show back then,
right.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's good to be put up against something really strong. Back then, there really was a bit of a zero-sum game to primetime network television.
Right.
So, when you're going up against Home Improvement, clearly the bar is a lot lower.
Right.
But we felt there was something going on. I think if Seinfeld came on today in the age of Twitter and everything, where buzz was something that mattered, it would have probably caught on quicker. I mean,
right.
I know in my personal life when I came out here, I would hear more and more people talking about the show.
Mm-hmm.
And but it took a while.
Yeah. So then you went to Fox in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And let's talk a minute or two about American Idol, because I kind of contend that, you know, back in 1963, when Kennedy was assassinated, the country needed something to get out of its funk. And the Beatles came along at just the right time a couple of months later. And in a sense, I always felt that American Idol was very similar in that it was after 9/11, and it came along, and like we needed something positive to focus on, and that became the zeitgeist hit.
I totally agree with you. I totally agree. I don't think anybody at Fox thought that it was going to be what it was going to be. And afterwards, thinking about it, and again, maybe my background, I was a sociologist before I went into this business.
Right.
Many of the things that you just said occurred to me, that I think the country needed something. And I think what was great about American Idol was it also put control of the process in the hands of the viewer.
Right.
So, you know, after seeing the devastation and everything we had seen, it was like, okay, I have input into this. I have some control over this event. And totally agree with you on that.
Yeah. And I think 24, which is also yes. Fox, was another show that people said, wow, here's Jack Bauer. This guy's actually doing something.
Right. And if you remember, the 24 pilot, and 24 was picked, was the pilot was made before September 11th.
Right. And you held it back, didn't you?
We were always going to hold it back because Fox had baseball in the fourth quarter.
Right.
So we always had to figure out our schedule, knowing that there was a World Series and back then the NLCS or the mm-hmm. ALCS. We actually had to edit the pilot because there was a scene of a plane being blown up,
and
we had to edit it. And again, that was another situation where we didn't know whether this was going to be rejected because of what had happened
mm-hmm.
or was going to be embraced, and fortunately, I think the casting of Kiefer Sutherland had a lot to do with the success of the show.
Mm-hmm. Interestingly, though, Fox has always had a tough time launching comedies, live mm-hmm. comedies.
Yes.
Why do you think that is?
I used to joke at work that we would ask, when we tested pilots, comedy pilots, we would always ask what network you thought the pilot would the best fit was.
Uh-huh.
And I would tell everybody, if the answer was Fox, don't pick it up. Because I think there was just, you know, the thing about Fox, and still true a little bit to this day, and we'll see what happens moving forward, they outlived their renegade status a long time ago.
Sure.
They are AARP yeah. members now, no matter what they think. And they like to think of themselves as edgy.
Yeah, they're no longer expansion teams
anymore.
Right.
Exactly. And I think what happened was with Fox is that everything had to be edgy and different. And as you and I know, being more veterans in this business, it's what worked 30 years ago still works today. In my opinion, you know, of course, you have to reflect the times that you live in and everything. But there was always an aversion to doing family comedies. There was always an aversion to doing multi-camera comedies, even though the big hits on Fox were all family comedies, happened to be animated.
Right.
But they were family comedies.
Sure.
And their biggest live-action comedies were multi-camera as opposed to single-camera. That 70s show
Yeah. Interesting.
Children.
You know, and the other problem, too, from my side as a producer,
mm-hmm.
you wouldn't bring your idea to Fox first because you figured the likelihood of success is less.
Yes.
So you weren't getting the best ideas brought to you, too. So
right.
it's kind of a vicious circle
we
there.
I don't know if they still do, they had a production deal with Steve Levitan, and we put on a lot of Steve's comedies, and I think he got so frustrated that when the gold standard came along in Modern Family,
right.
you know, Steve made it clear to me he doesn't want it on the network, and he
right.
was right.
Right.
But, yeah, there's always been an aversion to doing fastball down the middle mainstream comedy there.
So broadcasters pretty much have a different set of standards these days as to what constitutes a hit.
Mm-hmm.
Because for the Netflix of the world and the HBOs of the world, it's not necessarily ratings.
Right.
It's kind of different that they all have very specific guidelines for what is a hit on their platform, right?
Right, and I think even on the broadcast networks now, it used to be the bulk of the profit, if there was any, was through advertising.
Right.
And then secondarily syndication, if you happen to own it. With the emergence of streamers, networks have another source of income. So ownership in some ways became more important than ratings.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the, I think still, you know, you look at some of the numbers and you still go, come on, you know, I mean, this is rejection, but,
right.
but I think it's a lot easier to keep programs on the air. I remember a few years ago, Fox had a show called Scream Queens from Ryan Murphy.
Okay.
And even though, and they put a lot of marketing effort into it, and even though it was pretty much rejected, they still picked it up for a second season because of the relationship, of knowing that there were other platforms to put this show on. So ratings, although still important, are much less so even on the broadcast networks.
How come Netflix never divulges its numbers?
Why should they? I mean, they, you know, their standard is subs.
Right.
I don't think they want, this is my opinion.
Okay.
I don't think, first of all, I think if you saw the numbers, you would see that the bulk of Netflix viewing is to television shows.
As opposed to
Orange
original
is the New
content.
Black and uh-huh. House of Cards.
Right, right.
And I think that that's my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure it's true. You know, TV shows, movies, and that then down the rankings are their own programming. And I think that that's something that they like to use their programming as here's why you should subscribe to us.
Right.
But I think that the majority of viewing is to programming that they commission or, I mean, that mm-hmm. British programming
right.
or American programming.
I mean, I've always suspected that because if the numbers were great,
yes.
why wouldn't they crow about it?
I think
the fact that, you know, maybe yeah, more people are watching the Cheers reruns than House of Cards.
Yes.
And
I think you saw with that movie that they did around Christmas time, the Will Smith movie, I think it was called Bright.
Right. Mm-hmm.
There was some pounding of the chest at how many streams there were.
Uh-huh.
So, but that sort of, again, is an indication that if there was more of that, you would hear more about it.
So moving towards the networks, you know, they want ratings, mm-hmm. and they want specific ratings. They want 18 to 34, and we hear so much about the 18 to 34 demographic. Why exactly is that so cherished?
Well, really, it's 18 to 49.
Okay.
And also, I think on CBS, I'm sure, believes this, that it's really 18 to 54 or 25
uh-huh.
to 54. The argument has always been that you make your purchasing decisions early in your life and you develop brand loyalty. So therefore, by the time you're in your late 30s, 40s, if you're going to buy a Toyota, you're going to buy a Toyota. If you're
right.
going to use this toothpaste, you're going to use this toothpaste. So getting people early in their purchase, when they're beginning to make their purchasing decisions, has a lot to do with the emphasis on the 18 to 49. Then it depends on the network. You know, at Fox, part of the appeal was male 18 to 34, especially mm-hmm. on Sunday night with the animated shows. CBS has always been an older, more 25, 54 audience, although if you look at their 18 to 49 ratings, they're comparable to the other networks. So, but that's pretty much has been the reason.
It's interesting that CBS has always decided to just, you know, go for a broader audience.
Yes, yes.
And look, us baby boomers, we have the money.
right.
So CBS is probably able to sell advertising as a result of attracting our old useless demographic.
That's why I think, you know, you'll probably see more pharmaceutical ads on
CBS. Oh, yes, I know, yeah. Every ad on CBS, you know, warns you, you know, if you take this, you're going to die.
Yeah. Exactly. Why should you take it?
Right.
I think that, you know, to their credit and to Les Moonves' credit and Kelly Call, who's now running it, who I've known, fellow scheduler, which is great, they just never wavered from being a broadcaster. They never wanted to be anything but a broadcaster. I coined this term when I was at Fox. I called it cable envy, where broadcast networks felt they needed to do the shows that work on cable, and you know, they got to go for, instead of doing 22 or 24 episodes, we're going to do 13 episodes. And I always felt it was just, hey, if that's what you want to do, go work for a cable network. But if you're in the broadcast business, be a broadcaster.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that Fox was targeting men. Do certain networks value women over men or men over women?
Well, I think that the driver to television viewing, at least on the networks, and I think probably even beyond, are women.
Okay.
If you try to go after a younger audience, or especially a male audience, they're more fickle and they're less likely to stick with the programming. So I think, you know, the smartest thing any network can do is to be a big tent broadcaster. Say, mm-hmm. okay, what are the kind of shows that are going to get the biggest audiences? And if I get the biggest audiences, I will get my 18 to 49. I mean, a perfect example of that is what Fox has been doing with X-Files and 911. Where X-Files is, even though it's, you know, it's historically one of the great shows, you know, it's a narrow audience. And 911, which has never existed before Ryan Murphy came, well, mm-hmm. his version of it, is a broader show. When you look at the ratings and you see that 911 gets about 2-3 million more viewers than the X-Files and gets about 50% larger rating among 18 to 49s. Hmm. So I still think it's the case that, you know, going broad, going with the ideas. Empire was a show everybody pointed to the success of it as having something to do with the African-American audience, which was very important. But at the end of the day, it's Dynasty and it's Dallas. And
right.
it's the classic form of a soap that works. So every once in a while something breaks out and everybody chases that.
Sure, yeah, it's a big hit, and so, yeah, there's Friends, and so there's 9 million Friends right. clones, yeah.
Right, so everybody yeah. chases that, and then, you know, but meanwhile, if you just stick to your knitting and you focus on the kinds of shows that have worked in the past and that continue to work, you'll be fine.
Empire and the polka industry, you know,
well, yeah.
something like that,
right.
yeah.
We did, it's funny, again, at Fox, we did a show called Skin, which was about the adult film industry.
Okay.
And was, again, one of these Empire down, and we refused to promote it as what it was. And we turned it into a Romeo and Juliet, and uh-huh. it failed. And, uh-huh. you know, I mean, I always felt, hey, say what it is, and people will realize it. You're talking about a big business, and you're talking about two families that are at odds with each other.
Right.
There you go.
And that's the attraction
exactly.
of the show. Yeah. Somebody in scheduling said that if you're trying to attract women, the two types of shows that women seem to respond to the best are procedurals and multi-camera comedies. Is that true?
Yeah, definitely procedurals.
Mm-hmm.
I thought you were going to say soaps.
No.
I thought you were going to say, I would agree with that. Especially family comedies.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, if you look at ABC's lineup, it's pretty much wall-to-wall different versions of family comedies.
Right.
So, yeah, I would agree with that.
Okay. What percentage of the audience today actually watches a show when it airs?
Ooh, that's a good... You know, again, I've been retired for a few years. I do keep up. I would say... if you're looking at the first 7 days of, in other words, live plus 7 days beyond
right,
that,
right.
you're probably talking about, and again, it depends on the form a little bit, but probably, I think we're probably at a point now where for some shows, more than half of the viewing takes place beyond the initial live telecast.
Mm-hmm.
If it's sports, it's far
sure.
less so.
Of course.
Reality shows, reality competition shows, you'll oftentimes see viewing closer to live.
Right.
Dramas, you generally see the biggest growth from live to 7 days after.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and none of this takes into account, you know, the show's life beyond the broadcast network. But I would say a good measure is around 50%. Yeah.
Wow. I would imagine, too, there is a larger percentage of the audience than we realize that doesn't have DVRs, you know, that basically watch television from antennas.
That I don't know. I honestly don't know. I think that the era of the DVR is waning a little bit as video on demand is coming along. And, you know, places like Hulu, where if you subscribe to Hulu, you can get the show the day after.
Right.
So I think that I find that even in my own personal viewing, even HBO Go, even though I have HBO, I have DirecTV. I don't know if any of these are answering you. But I find that rather than DVRing a show like Game of Thrones, even, unless I'm going to watch it live,
right?
I sooner will watch it on HBO Go because the quality of is better because you're dealing with less transfer of data. You're going right, you know, it's a stream versus up, down into your TV. So I find that my consumption of television is moving somewhat away from a DVR and more towards other ways of viewing a show as closer to air as possible.
And a new method of watching TV these days is binge watching.
Yeah.
Which, you know, do you approve of binge watching?
You know, it's really funny that you say that. Last night, I watched a show, a Netflix show, even though it's British, called, I won't use the word, but End of the Effing World.
Okay.
And it was...
Actually, you can say that on the podcast, but okay. You can say world.
Okay. Yeah. anyway, it was 8 episodes. Each episode was around 20 minutes. So basically, it's a movie.
Uh-huh.
Okay?
Yeah.
And I watched the whole thing because my wife happened to be out. And I said, "What? You know, I didn't know whether she'd want to watch it or not." And when I was driving here today, I was saying to myself, you know, at the end of the year, everybody has these, you know, best of lists and whatever.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Now, I watched something in one day, in one evening. Is that a TV show? You know, what is it? Binge, you know, it's funny. Some shows I find that even though I can, you know, the whole thing drops, it might take me 4 or 5 weeks to watch it. I remember the first season of House of Cards. It literally took me 13 weeks to watch 13 episodes.
Okay.
I find, again, personally, half hours I'll watch, I can binge a show like Transparent or whatever because you can get through a lot of episodes.
Right.
I find the hour shows start to... We don't binge them as much as we might watch them over a week or 2 weeks. Do I approve of it? I think television is becoming more like reading a book. And I think what binge viewing is reading a book. I mean, I've been reading the Trump book, and it's taking me about 2 or 3 days. And
right.
How
you
different
want to kill
is,
yourself. And
well,
then,
yeah, right. Yeah. Well, how different is that from binge watching, where you say, okay, I'm going to take something, a piece of work, and I'm going to consume it as quickly as I can. I mean, I find that for some shows, the quicker you watch it, the more you can follow the story.
Yes,
you know,
yes,
and that's very true. Value of binge watching.
Yeah, you're not going, wait a minute, who is she again?
Yeah, I mean, then, you know, obviously comedies, procedurals, you can watch at your leisure. So there are certain shows that will just pile up on the DVR because it's like, oh well, I don't. And then, you know, maybe I'll watch 2 or 3, and then a month later I'll watch a few more. So I think it depends on the show. More and more, especially the kinds of stuff you see on the Netflixes and the Amazons, they're really one story cut up into 7 or 8 or 9 hours or half hours. So it really helps to sometimes watch it as quickly as you can.
See, I told you, great stuff. Part 2 is next week. And next week, we'll get into some TV ratings, research, building a schedule, counter-programming, all kinds of great stuff. That is Preston Beckman, who, by the way, is a daily contributor to TV by the Numbers under his persona of The Masked Scheduler. And you can follow him on Twitter, @MaskedScheduler. Again, our thanks to Preston Beckman, along with Adam and Susie Meister-Butler, Howard Hoffman, John Wolford, and Randy Thomas. If you have any comments, anything at all that you want to share with me, I am reachable via HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. Again, that's HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. And yes, I will write you back. Now, I have a birthday coming up here in a couple of weeks, and of course, everybody wants to know what to get me. A five-star review on iTunes, okay? Thanks very much. Part two with Preston Beckman coming up next week. Thanks so much for listening. Talk to you then. Bye-bye. Hollywood.